pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times, somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
Women make up 34% of the Habitat organization's workforce and are having a major impact on conservation across the country. In this special Women on the Wing series, we're going to explore their professional journeys, do deep dives into their areas of expertise, and talk about what conservation means to them. Hey, Britta, what's new with you?
Hey, Ashley. We got through our technical difficulties, so we're ready to roll. Excited to chat today.
We arrived on the scene here by our bootstraps, but the important thing is we're here. And today I'm really excited because Allie is here with us and we are going to learn about her experiences in the field and what she specializes in for her work. Allie, to kick us off, can you tell us what kind of boots you wear and why?
Oh, goodness. Ones that fit well, which is
smart.
Seems basic, but I think for especially women in the field, that can actually be a way harder feat, pun intended, to overcome than normal. So whatever's cheap as possible fits well and keeps my feet dry. So I couldn't even tell you what I'm wearing. I have a couple different ones. I do mucks normally for my like rubber boot version. Field boot, I would say, is more potentially like Walmart brand type.
When you're going to put miles on, you might as well, right? Just wear them out.
Yeah, right.
Britta, I know you have a fair amount of boot drama in your life. Do you want to elaborate on where you're at right now?
I'm coming to the realization that maybe it's just that I don't know what size that I'm supposed to be wearing. So maybe that would help. But my boot drama involves tiny, skinny little ankles and very big feet. So then it is not a good combination when trying to find boots. So I'm still working on finding a brand that actually fits. So I try a lot and seem to not find anything that is great. Everything is pretty mediocre.
Man, I can identify. A couple years ago, we went up north. I live in Tennessee now, but I'm from Minnesota. And we went up there for a combo grouse and pheasant hunt. We were going to be up there for 2 weeks. And my boots were just terrible. Every time I wore them, I got blisters. And so I broke down and went into a Red Wing store. And I bought a pair of Irish Setter wing shooters. And that was a splurge. And they did me well for a little while. But after, you know, having a kid, my feet are different. And I don't know. It's ongoing. I'll say that. I still have them, but we're not as good of friends as we used to be. So, Allie, you are a senior farm bill biologist in Iowa. Could you tell us what brought you to the organization? How did you land here?
Yeah. So the very front part of my career, ever since middle of college, I was working public lands, doing the kind of hands-on work management myself. I was loving the crap out of it. And the only thing that turned me over to look at something somewhat different was I was tired of applying for temporary positions like every 6 months, basically. So there wasn't a lot of full-time work at that point. For Iowa DNR and kind of around the Iowa area, although I had also been to a lot of other states. I was kind of just ready to make something a little more permanent. So one of my old colleagues for Iowa DNR, Susan, had told me about, she had done this like little stint with this Pheasants Forever position, and I knew nothing of Pheasants Forever either. So I was like, okay, cool. And then it just kind of like plooped out of my mind. And just while I was looking at jobs one day online, I saw the title. I didn't ever look at who was producing them. I saw this title of Farmville Wildlife Biologist, and I was like, what the heck is that? So I started reading, and I was like, ooh, this sounds real cool. And then the location said, like, Southwest Kansas, and I had never been there before, knew nothing of Kansas, and I was quite the jet setter at that point, and I was like, oh, I don't know this, so let's do that. And that was over 12 years ago. Threw my name in the hat, somehow got it, and kind of just fell in love with the position and everything it allowed us to do.
12 years, man, you're the OG Farm Bill biologist. It's for those of us that are here or have been with PF for less than that, definitely it's nice to have folks that know what they're doing on board that we can look up to. So I enjoy getting to have Allie as a colleague, that's for sure.
That's very, yeah, OG, very sweet, no doubt.
I'm curious, so I'm relatively new to the organization. I think I'm in my 8th or 9th month at this point. When you started, Allie, rough estimate, how many farm bill biologists do you think there were in the country compared to how many we have now?
Ooh. Maybe like 80, 100, because we're what into like the 250s almost right now. Yeah,
I think so. I think we're close to hitting that 300 mark. And I think actually, we've just passed Fish and Wildlife Service for the number of private lands biologists in the country. So we're up there.
Yeah, I think back then it was still just a lot of the Midwest plains states at that point, and really started shooting out sideways from there. So yeah, there wasn't, I think we had like 5 in Kansas at that point, and that felt like pretty populated from at that point at least.
Hey Allie, do you know when maybe they're either in Kansas or in Iowa, do you know, did they all start as farm bill biologists, and was their workload kind of looking at that whole upland? I know, because here in Wisconsin, it was 2007, I think, was when we first started the farm bill biologist program, but they were actually specifically tasked with a lot of the wetland easement workload that's here in Wisconsin, which, you know, is different, I think, than maybe some of those more traditional plain states. Do you know the background on your states?
For, I would say Kansas and Iowa, I think they have kind of always been the more of the basic generalist farm bill wildlife biologist with maybe, that kind of emphasis to the upland, kind of a nonverbal targeted area, but just kind of whatever your local area was wanting to push and what you yourself kind of also wanted to push, had that flexibility.
So how long did you end up staying in Kansas?
I was there for about 5 years. I was in Southwest Kansas for 2, and I loved it so much. The only thing that kind of pushed me out was, as much as I loved the landscape, and it was actually where I got my first pheasant. It's funny, growing up in Iowa, and I was not part of a hunting family, so I learned to hunt and got my first pheasant in Kansas, which just seems weird. But Southwest Kansas and Western Kansas is pretty, has long returns on their fire regime, and there's a lot of people that are just really nervous and scared to burn. So burning is one of my passions. And so it was hard to not have much of that to do or talk about with folks. So then 2 years later, I moved to kind of central Kansas, Salina, Abilene area, in the middle of tall grass and some short grass, some mixed grass areas, Flint Hills and Konza Prairie and all that stuff. Things that I had like learned about in school was kind of a like a 360 of coming back around to things that I never thought I'd actually experience. And then got to work with a lot of folks that used fire quite frequently, not only for their CRP or prairie management, but also for like native grazing range, rangeland for cattle and everything like that. So, unfortunately our agreement had kind of, ended in Kansas, and it was a quick turnaround to what do I do now. And at that time there were some positions that opened up in Iowa, and I thought, well, maybe it's time to go back home. So Northeast Iowa for about 3 or 4 years, and then where I'm at now, kind of East Central Iowa, is home base for the last 4 years, and loving it still.
Very cool. Is that where you're from? Like that, the specific area where you live now, is it like functionally hometown territory?
No. I grew up in Southeast Iowa, just south of Iowa City area a little bit. So, I'm not too far from it. I still get to see some old friends and whatnot every once in a while. But the area I'm in is pretty new territory, but becoming home-like fairly fast.
So you don't have to like go back for all the gender reveal parties if you don't want to. It's like that distance.
No, that stuff's already happened too. Like the OG part, there's heavy on the O of the OG. all those friends have come and gone with babies.
Nice. Well, talking about fire is a perfect segue into one of our first questions for you. With burn season upon us, this episode is going to air late March. Can you talk to us about prescribed fire, specifically like when to burn and why, and like how all of that comes together?
Absolutely. So you want to try and figure out what you currently have out there, which is maybe one of the hardest things for a lot of landowners to do. And that's absolutely where, you know, our types of positions can come in and help out to give you an idea of what your benchmark is, and then try and figure out how you could improve it. Like if you have a lot of native grasses, but you don't have a lot of wildflowers, then you and or your private lands kind of conservationist can help, you know, let you know, hey, you know, maybe some wildflowers would be good to have out here. And knowing what you're kind of going after can help decide when you want to burn, because whenever you burn throughout the year, you're going to be stimulating something and you're going to be decreasing something. So that time frame totally will navigate what you're trying to get after. So if you want more wildflowers, you need to burn way earlier in the year, like right as soon as the snow moves on, or late in the year, summer through fall, possibly. If you've got some non-native cool season grasses that are creeping in and you're trying to keep your stand mostly native, then you'd want to try and do a late spring burn, about as late as you can possibly stand it before nesting season starts. And that's going to help set back those non-native cool season grasses, because they're up and going. They've got their growing point out of the ground, and sending fire through at that point can really help hurt them and make room for more of the native grasses to come through as well. So you kind of have to know a little bit of what do you have and what are you trying to get after to know what kind of time of year would be best to burn. All that aside, I am a believer that burning at any time, even if you're not sure what you're actually going after, burning is still better than not burning. If it was a either or situation. And then trying to get that burn done safely and effectively is a whole other ball of wax. Whether you're going to try and do it yourself, and then you better start, you know, watching some videos and asking folks and getting neighbors and Joe Bob that hunts the property on X number of days to come help you, or you try and find that contractor or volunteer fire department to come help do that for you, because it's very easy to say, oh, you should burn it this day for this reason. Actually doing the burn is way harder and scarier for a lot of people. It's one of those things, like the more you do or the more you're involved with it, the more you can understand it. But it is its own process. There is like a method to doing it, not just the lighting it and then heading to the local bar for a drink, come back, see how it does. It's not like brush piles. It's not like even timber burns. Prairie burns are totally different, and you don't want to get too involved with them or have too much responsibility with them without dipping your toe into participating on a burn or two with other experienced folks. Because being on the burn is one of the best teachers that you can have.
Allie, do you find that the landowners that you work with, are they mostly doing it themselves, or do they hire contractors? Is a little bit of both. I know here in Wisconsin, it's both, but I feel like in the Southwest in particular, we kind of are running into that limitation with contractors. There's not enough of them, and that burn window is so short that, you know, there's just not enough people. So we're trying to encourage that learning, like you were just talking about, of, you know, helping your neighbors so that you learn, and then maybe you can go out and help others. But do you have a feel for in Iowa how that's working?
Yeah, I would say very similarly, a little bit of both, but I am actually quite impressed that there's probably more people doing burns on their own. And I think it's unfortunately because the lack of contractors that are available, the time frame that they're available, and like when they need to get their mid-contract management done by, and all this stuff kind of pushes them more and more to doing it themselves. And which is great, but it is quite an investment in time and knowledge and learning. But once you get into it, then it's kind of one of those things that will just, you know, be forever. And hopefully most people get that enjoyment out of it that I believe at least you and I probably do.
Yeah. What's your favorite part of a burn? I mean, I know there's probably lots of folks that would drop a match and, you know, say the big flameage, which is maybe one of yours. But yeah, what's your favorite part, man?
Lighting that fire. Yeah. One of the best parts of helping other partners is their organizations don't give you liability insurance to run equipment. So then you're normally, quote unquote, stuck with the lighting responsibility, which is great because I could do that all day, every day. But I do think that's not to say that other parts aren't tremendously important, and I've done all of those as well. Definitely breathe in a lot of smoke doing the backfire, stomping out, and learned a lot of lessons in that frame of mind as well. But there's just nothing better than that. Lighting the fire, potentially that big woof of convective heat that comes from that flame explosion, to kind of err on the side being too demonstrative. But it's an adrenaline rush.
So I'm curious, Allie, if I'm a landowner, let's say I've got, you know, 20 acres and I want to burn 7 of it. It's, you know, maybe it's largely prairie or something like that. How do I get experience burning before, you know, trying to bring it to my own property, what would a person do?
Yeah, that's a great question and can be hard to implement. Like Britta had mentioned, if you have a neighbor or somebody you know personally that is going to be doing a burn, that could be the easiest way, most opportunity to get on a burn. You could reach out to your local, like, county conservation board or your local state agency, DNR, public lands. They'll be doing management burns for sure. However, they'll have their own set of restrictions and requirements. Like, you might need S-130, 190, which is a set of certifications that a lot of folks that are in the professional conservation field get as kind of a baseline understanding of wildfire and fire activity. So you might have to spend the time to kind of do some of those, which you can do most of that online nowadays. But I would say just reaching out to some of those agencies and organizations that you might see doing burns around your area and just see what you can be a part of, even if you're not necessarily like holding the drip torch or even being technically on the burn, being there to watch what everything is happening, where everybody's located, where you're starting the burn versus where the wind is pushing it. All those things can be very beneficial to just kind of understand what that method is for, you know, burning and how there is a method to it.
So tap your networks, tap your wildlife agencies writ large and see what you can find. So I do have some background in fire. I did some firefighting in college and also have performed prescribed fire as part of, you know, a number of jobs. And when I did my undergrad in the Midwest, and what I remember, this is a long time ago now, I'm not going to say how many years, what I remember from that was like, you know, there's a spring fire season and there's a fall fire season, and that's, you know, and I might probably didn't get a holistic view of it, but for what I participated in, that was kind of the gist of it. And then I moved to the Southeast, and in Mississippi, I was exposed to, I was part of some growing season burns, and that was like, oh my, wow, this is like the whoosh, it was crazy. And I didn't even know stuff could burn midsummer. So I don't know, can you, maybe both of you, just talk about, is that something that happens very frequently in the Midwest? If so, what's the vegetative response afterwards?
My experience, is that it's becoming more and more a thing. I think at least in my career, it's kind of been, yeah, that spring burn, fall burn, but I think it seems like I've been hearing more and more, examples of that like growing season burn happening. I know where I'm from, originally in Northwest Wisconsin, there's a big wildlife area up there, and it's really like a wetland complex, but they have a ton of growth of oaks and shrubs coming in. And so they've been implementing more and more growing season burns to try to reduce that and keep the grass and sedge component there, and have been seeing some success. So yeah, it's becoming more and more a thing. And I think it is definitely beneficial. And again, when that burn window is so short, I think we got to find ways to try different things. And you know, if we're finding some success, keep doing it and just building on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Ashley, I spent a year in Southeast Florida and also had similar like aha moments of, wait, you guys burn like every single day of the year? This is crazy and so cool. And yes, how do you do that? It's cool to learn about, you know, the oils that certain plants produce to kind of make them burn even hotter and quicker. And
just hot tip for everybody, palmetto is always flammable. You can yes. always light it on fire.
Yes, it is. Man, that was some cool stuff. And then in, I don't know if maybe that's what stimulated this idea in my brain or just some of my time in Kansas, that summer burn I learned a lot more about, even in the Plains and Midwest area, and how great it can be. A, it's super space, natural, not supernatural, but it's very natural. If you look back at when fire was just happening on the landscape, way back when it happened, summer thunderstorms and all that, you know, so that plus being able to burn something while it's growing to reduce it a little bit, especially out in Kansas, it was a lot of heavy native grass plantings. And so that it would just over time, those native grasses would start choking out other wildflowers and other diversity. So burning in summer when they are actively growing the most could really help set back those native grasses, allow some more native flowers to come through. Also a great time to set back volunteer trees and shrubs in your prairie. And then, like you said, Britta, just allow another portion of time for an opportunity to burn. Another thing that was also really big was the fact that usually summer burns, there's a higher humidity in the air, which makes a lot of those burns actually safer. Especially if you're trying to burn like a clump or a field of prairie, and there's something next to it, which is also prairie, whether that's a neighbor or your own chunk, the example you had given earlier, Ashley, the chance of any of that spot fire happening is way reduced during the summer. So there's just a lot of potential benefits for it. However, that's always like in the back of my mind, if I find like the right landowner who might be interested in trying something cool. So I mention that every once in a while, but I haven't gotten a lot of people to bite on it. A lot of times it's because they're scared. We're Iowa. We got a lot of ag everywhere. Something's usually next to a cornfield. So being just super respectful neighbors, just, you know, not wanting to influence or potentially send any kind of fire through growing corn, that's a huge concern for a lot of folks around here. But I do see a lot of potential benefit, and hopefully someday we can have that become more of the norm.
All right, calling all cool landowners in Iowa. Ellie wants to talk to you. She's got an
that's
idea.
Right.
I think getting on the subject of like historical fire regimes and fire timing is fascinating. I mean, you know, in this country, we've gone through a long period of fire suppression, which led to, you know, a number of problems. I feel like now we're at a place where we're getting much better at society, at least in some arenas, accepting fire as an important management tool, and we're able to implement it. But a lot of times it seems it's asynchronous with the historical timing. Another thing I picked up in Mississippi was, and I'm not going to be able to quote these data and this literature very well, but essentially that those late summer fires that historically would have begun from thunderstorms were really important for deer in particular to provide forage during you know, when a doe is lactating in that late summer, kind of there's no food on the landscape. So there's very real implications for wildlife and, you know, management writ large, but that's probably a whole nother episode that we could explore is fire timing. Okay, I think we could talk fire all day, but Allie knows about even more stuff. So I think I would like to hear about CRP, which I'll preface by saying I'm new to the organization, and Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever is like the ultimate acronym hub. And so even now, still in conversation with people, they'll throw out acronyms. I'm like, whoa, can you spell that out for me? Cause I don't know what it means. So, Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, what are they? Why should landowners try to take advantage of them? Yeah, let's get the insider scoop.
Awesome. Another topic that I could talk on forever. So I will try and be concise. So the Conservation Reserve Program is a voluntary program for landowners and operators who right now the eligibility for getting into it is having some sort of crop history from dates ranging from 2012 through 2017. If you have that on a piece of your ground, then you possibly could be eligible for some sort of CRP. So when I say that, there's like, I don't know, 50 some different CRP practices at this point. Some are, you know, there's three main objectives to CRP: soil, water, and wildlife. So CRP practices will be at least touching one of those objectives for what they're benefiting. Some, anything that's wildlife related is going to be also covering all the soil and water quality benefits as well. You have a contract that's anywhere from 10 to 15 years. Every one of those years, you get a annual rental payment. That rental payment is based off of kind of the quality of your soil. But normally, the better quality of soil you have, the more productive your soil is, the higher rental rate that you would receive. So then,
and I guess that would be a good point to, or like before, you know, most of what Allie's talking about right now is across the nation, but each state's do vary. So it can be different, which is again why it's this huge 800-pound gorilla. And so it is different, which is why Allie and I are on the ground to help out. But it's a big program. So not to derail you, Allie, keep going.
No, that's great. That's a great point. Not only is it different in every state, but then kind of every county. And so really, if you're not even sure if you're eligible or what it really all entails, I would definitely recommend going into your local USDA service center and talking with the Farm Service Agency or the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Both sides put work together to deliver this program to folks. We each kind of have our own little separation of duties, but you know, you'll want to talk to both sides to figure out what are my responsibilities over here, what I might get paid, what potential cost share might I get for implementing these practices on the ground, and then what might be required for maintenance and management throughout that program lifespan. But yeah, so you'd get the annual payment every year, and then you normally get some sort of cost share for what we're asking you to do to establish whatever kind of practice you might be involved with. So a lot of it could be native prairie type of establishment. And so the seed mix, the seeding itself, and potentially establishment mowings for the first year, that can be cost shared by the Farm Service Agency. So you get a lot of good financial benefits to implementing what would be good wildlife habitat at the same time. So it's a win-win for folks that have any desire to, you know, seed something perennial to their ground, to help stop soil erosion, improve their water quality, or have any amount of increased wildlife habitat on their ground. CRP is just a great opportunity for you to look into.
Yeah, and I would say, I think that sometimes folks hear from their neighbors about the program, and maybe they don't have all the information correct. And so, you know, just like Allie said, reaching out to your Farm Bill biologist with Pheasants Forever or your agency folks is really good, because that's going to get you the correct information. And there's actually quite a bit of flexibility, I'd like to think, with some of that. I mean, you can... with seed mixes and that type of thing, I mean, you really can have a range of what you are wanting to do and get it done through the program. So CRP train right, all the so, way.
Yeah, yeah. What Britt is saying is CRP is for everyone.
That's right. And I think, and I do feel like our positions we do pride ourselves on knowing these programs kind of inside and out. So we do know where those flexibilities are of, okay, we can go out this way on this normal rule, but we know this loophole that can get you some extra wildlife habitat this way. Or, you know, that's definitely a big part of our job, is knowing it inside and out, so we can make it digestible and translate it to landowners that don't, you know, that most people don't know the ins and outs and what's all available.
Yeah, I've never been a farm biologist, but I recently went to a meeting where a number of farm biologists here in Tennessee were walking through some trainings as a group collectively, and I got to kind of look over their shoulders, and I think the pharmacobiologist title could be changed to Houdini of habitat, because I feel like, you know, this is a federal program that's being, you know, it's by definition, it has to be a blanket application across the U.S. with obviously some different things that happen in different states. But really, you all are the people that can, you know, ensure that a landowner is being compliant with the program, but also reaching their goals and providing the maximum benefit to wildlife in that spot, right? In that localized area, which is different than somewhere, you know, the next state over, or maybe even a couple counties over. So, I mean, huge, incredible resource. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's free to talk to you guys about this.
I frequently forget about that. I mean, I know it because I live it every day that it's free, but it's such an underrated factor to talk about that through our partnerships and agreements with all of our great agencies and organizations, our services are free to any of the landowners that we cover. And it can be a real, really good asset, because we are the ones that eat and digest all the alphabet soup that's out there and make it a lot more, you know, beneficial and easy for landowners to work through, and give them the options that really only pertain to their objectives and what would be a good program for them.
And I'm going to toot our horn in the sense of, like, we want it. We want to see prairie out on the landscape. We want to help wildlife habitat and help all that stuff. And so if you as a landowner want to talk to somebody that's passionate about it, then we are those people. I mean, if we're talking about native seed mixes and trying to design those, that's what we do. And that's one of the favorite parts of my job anyway, is getting a mess with making a mix that makes the landowners happy, and we get wildlife habitat, pollinator habitat on the ground, which is the best part of the day.
Absolutely. If I ever own ground, I'm going to buy it in somebody else's coverage area, hopefully Britta's, so that she can come out to my ground, tell me all the things, and just be enamored by her passion and just, like, enjoy it. I just want to receive the service at some point. That'd be great. Yeah.
Do you have, Allie, landowners, do you feel like, when landowners are coming to you, are there a majority of them that don't know a ton about, you know, say like a native planting, or that, you know, hey, they're really interested, they kind of know what they want coming in the door, or is it kind of a mix?
I would say it's heavy on the folks not knowing much of the prairie species and kind of that ecology. You do get a couple of ones that are already passionate. I don't have to sell them on anything, and they have a big, but I probably just don't work with them all that much, because they don't really need my help with anything except to possibly share some pictures back and forth and be like, yeah, that's some cool stuff. But the other folks that you get to make an impression on and sell them on prairie and cool plants and how this all interacts with everything, when they were just coming in there to, hey, I just want to sign up for a CRP, and now you're telling me all this cool stuff, and then they're actually buying into it. Yeah, it's a lot of that, and that's also probably the most rewarding part of it all for me.
So, Allie, in doing this for 12 years, if I remember correctly, I'm curious if there is an instance that stands out in your mind as like your biggest win with a landowner, or like something that, you know, just sticks out that you'll always remember that was really great.
Oh, I feel like I'm not going to be fair about this because it's 12 years is a lot of cool instances to happen. And my brain is so small nowadays.
It's okay if it's just the most recent one, yeah, or the one that comes to mind first. Right. It doesn't have to be the pinnacle.
Yeah. I don't know. There's one that sticks in my mind, just happened like a year or two ago, of a guy who had previously put in some CRP, was still cropping about half of his farm. And I didn't even work with him on the first CRP that he did. I was blessed enough to get to work with him on the second portion. And his unsolicited interest in it and commitment to it was just really cool to see. He went into a CRP practice we call Pheasant Recovery, and it requires a portion in food plot, a portion in winter cover, and the remaining in nesting. And he was game on all that, and then even doing a seeded fire break. Well, we had just briefly talked about all those requirements, and before I could even get back to the office from the field and start doodling that out myself, which is a huge portion of what we do, he comes back into the office with like the old school grid paper and had already drawn out where everything was going to be, and like to scale as well, already calculated the acres and everything. And I was just like, whoa. I said, can we hire you? You pretty much did a good chunk of the work for me. And it only got better from there, between working with him on his seed mix to implementing it. And Britta, you'll know, when you work with a landowner who is just excited and really receives everything you recommend and you tell them, and like implements it right away, it's just such a joy. And I still learn stuff when I go out there. He learns a little bit, and he's so excited about everything that he learns. Those are the landowners and the projects that keep my ambition going for at least another couple months till I get the next one.
Yeah, I think the landowners that are receptive to learning, and you know, if they're at that base level, are the best. And then, like you said, those ones that come in just having that knowledge, they're such a good teacher. So it's like getting that mix of people is, you never know who's going to walk in the door. You never know what you're going to have to do or learn that day, which keeps it exciting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I feel like it would not be a Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever situation if we didn't talk about dogs. So I have dogs, which, well, I can talk about them another time. Britta, I'm ashamed to admit, I don't even know if you have a dog. Do you have a dog?
I don't officially. I do. I think I have two siblings, and I think collectively all assume that the dog that my parents have is also ours. And so she is a fat little chunker lab, but does pretty good. She's real quirky, she's a trooper. So I kind of claim that one. And also a good friend of mine owns a poodle pointer, and so I've gotten to watch that dog and get to know a poodle pointer breed, so I'm a fan of that as well. And so there's a little place for Leo in my heart for sure too. So I'm an adoptive dog mom.
Heck yeah.
Fair enough. That, yeah, I think a lot of people can identify with that. Allie, my understanding is that you are a lab enthusiast, so sell us on labs.
Disclaimer, I've never had a dog before. This is my first one. I took, 6 months to 5 years to decide what breed I was going to get. Asked everybody, everything. Anybody could sell me on their dog within minutes. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm getting that one. And then I talked to the next person. I was like, oh, yeah, that I'm definitely getting that one. So that's why it took me forever to decide. But kind of ended up with just like, you know, not draining me completely of money to get him. He's a chocolate lab. At one point, I just kind of pulled the trigger. A colleague friend had gotten a dog out of this same breeder and so whatnot. But I don't know, he's pretty cool. He's got a lot of personality. He challenges me. I've learned so much from him. He's psycho at the right times.
Oh my gosh, that's like... my dog completely. And the wrong times too, unfortunately, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, like, I think he's good about shutting off the psycho when he's indoors. I'd like to say some of that is due to my training, but with him. But he's just so versatile. He's become like a great part of our family. I love what he does outside. I have this, I don't know if anybody will be able to relate to this, but my nervous system is like so short or sensitive, whatever. I don't know what it has come from, but like even in the office, there's like 20 of us in the office. I'll turn the corner fully knowing that somebody's coming down the hallway and I will jump. And they'll apologize. I'll be like, nope, it has nothing to do with you. And just anything will just do that. So the idea of having a pointer and having to walk up and like flush it myself was an absolute nightmare to be thinking about for years and years. So I'm like, oh, I need this dog to do this work for me so that I don't, you know, relieve myself while I'm hunting at the same time every time. So that's one of the main reasons why I went with that with labs. And I just heard a lot of my colleagues are lab enthusiasts and I've hunted and met many of them. And so I don't know, they were all great. And I would love any dog that I ended up with. I'm just, right now I have labs, but now that I have them, I also don't know that I can go any other direction from here on out. And I might just have to change the color of the lab. And that's shake one day up a I'll bit. Have yellow, chocolate, and black. I think that's what we'll do someday.
Man, I've always said that labs, I think, also fit me very well because they're kind of like mediocre at everything. And
oh, yes.
I really enjoy everything. Like I duck hunting, pheasant hunting, grouse hunting. I like doing it all. So I feel like I can't pick one to like really try and do only that. I want to do it all. So like the labs kind of fill that void of like, they're not great at everything, but they'll be enthusiastic about everything and they'll kind of get it done for you. So that's why I kind of think when I get my own, it's going to have to be a lab.
That's man, perfect, Britta. That
you guys
awesome.
Are selling me on this. We have a flusher. We have a English Springer Spaniel, and he's 7, and he's still just nuts all day, every day. Now, granted, if we work him appropriately, he's a much better dog in the house, but we've got a 2.5-year-old daughter, and his tolerance for her is like 0, and so my tolerance for him has become negative. And so I'm thinking back to all the labs, they're farm labs that we had growing up, but the abuse that they put up with smiles on their faces, I'm like, yeah, you know what? We have a Roomba now. The hair was always a big concern for me. I'm like, I think the next one could be a lab. Go labs. Okay. I love my dog, by the way, but I just want to kill him sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Totally relate. Yeah.
As with all close and important relationships. All right, Allie, I want to get kind of like an insider perspective on your experience. So I'm curious about either aspects of your job that have been really challenging, or which we touched on a little bit already, things that you really love, or both?
Yes. I would say some of the hardest thing with this job is covering several counties and having so many partners to work with and all the different offices. It's hard not to feel like you're disappointing somebody at some point, because there's only one of you and you've got all this area to cover and you want to be everything for everybody. I know I put that on myself a lot. That's not necessarily provoked by any one person or anything like that, but it's just, you establish these relationships with all these folks that you work with, and you want them to see the benefit that you provide, and then they want to utilize that benefit, which is the name of the game and what the job is. And then you become desired, if you will, by many people, and not being able to provide all the things to everybody in a timely manner is something that weighs heavy on me, but something I have to, as a grown adult, I gotta start.
As they call me.
Yeah. I just have to like work through that and know that I'm doing the best I can. But yeah, that can be a hard pill to swallow.
You're not alone, man. I think that, and I don't know if it is just in our profession, right? Because we're in it and we experience it. I do feel like, you know, when you reach out across our organization or even just other conservation professionals, I feel like we feel that passion so innately that we want to do good things. And so just like you're saying, you build those relationships and you want to see that prairie planted or that oak savanna restored or whatever it is. And so I think that it is a hard thing to juggle and to manage, you know, much like everyone else's jobs has a lot of duties as well. But when you are so passionate about, you know, caring and that thinking about moving forward with the change on the landscape, I think we all take that, you know, and hold that in our hearts too, which then makes it harder if you feel like you're letting somebody down.
Yes, absolutely. The solution would be more biologists on the ground to take up less, you know, less room for me, more room for them kind of situation. But we're slowly working there.
Yes. Okay, this, you can give the same answer if you want, but maybe hopefully you'll come up with a different one. If you were queen for a day, so no rules, no restrictions, you're the queen, what would you change to impact conservation?
I feel like I may have undersold my response to this. It will be different. For me right now, it's just having some sort of land management or habitat management crew available for every county in the state/nation, because it's not a lack of desire for people to want to do good things and to manage their volunteer trees and to get that burned over there. It's the lack of ability or know-how or time. And if we just had these crews like readily available for folks to contract with, then I think habitat would be a whole different game in our state, at least.
Amen for Wisconsin. That's what we need to.
Yes.
This sounds like a utopia, or like a CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps 2.0. I know that was talked about somewhere in the last few years in government affairs, but man, that'd be something. It would be really, jobs in the conservation field would be really competitive about 10 years after that happened. So, hidden cost. I love that. All right, we're getting to the end here. I think in closing, I would love to go around the horn and hear everybody's most recent adventure or what's coming up for each of us. Britt, I'm going to put you on the spot. You want to start us off?
Fantastic. just winter activities is the most recent thing, you know, trying to experience the last of winter as much as possible. I'm a northerner, so getting out and as much winter activity, bombing around on sites that I'm familiar with when it's green, but I like seeing when it's white. And I think moving forward, it's March now, we're going to be looking at burn season, so getting excited about that. And then shortly after that is turkey season, so we've got lots of excitement coming with the spring. So,
Allie, yes. What about you?
Awesome. Anything that I can take the dog out to is a wonderful day for me. He also needs a lot of energy release in order to be like a cool dog. So just having it not be cold enough or too cold to go out. We like to explore timber areas, wetland areas, mushroom hunting. It's going to be happening here soon along with turkey hunting. I wish I could take my dog turkey hunting. I'm trying to think about how I can incorporate that into in training. Oh, just legally. Oh, I'm not even sure. Oh, I should check
you
on
can,
that.
Yeah.
He just wouldn't like, there's no way he would sit still long enough for if any object came in sight, he'd be like, I'm after that. Yeah. So probably some turkey hunting in the upcoming time as well.
Oh, that's that. Yes. I'm not going to be doing any turkey hunting this spring because I'm having a baby in May, our second kid, and I turkey hunted extremely pregnant with our last child, and I'm not going to hit the repeat button on that. Just not
Congrats.
Athletic enough for that to be fun at that point in pregnancy. But yeah, I think our most recent adventure, we went, so here in Tennessee, we rarely get snow, but we got 8 inches recently and it stuck around for like 5 or 6 days. Schools were shut down for a week and 2 days. It's like, you know, apocalypse. But we went rabbit hunting, my husband and I and our daughter with a friend of ours that runs beagles. And on the drive out, my daughter, we got her a wooden gun for Christmas. And she's asking like, where's my gun? And then we're like, we left it at home because, you know, her hands are like duct taped up in mittens. Like she can't hold it. She can't even walk through the snow. And she starts crying. This is like fat tears. Like, I wanted to shoot a rabbit. So, the most heartbreaking thing, to see that. And we're like, yeah, sorry, honey. You know? And so we get out there and it's like 1 degree, and I'm decently pregnant, so my husband had her in a carrier on his back most of the time, and I don't know, she's short on sleep, and rabbit hunting wasn't her scene, apparently. We couldn't really get any races going either, so there wasn't a lot of action, but anyway, we ended up leaving early, but it was fun to be out there in it with her, and it was sunny that day too, so even though it was cold, it was nice.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, that sounds like a blast. Well, both like super exciting for the future if she's that passionate, but also I can understand in the moment was maybe not that much fun.
Yeah, that is sporting activities with kids. I feel like it's like the type 2 fun, I think I've heard it described as. So in the moment, there's definitely some expectation adjustments that need to happen. But now, you know, we sit down to dinner. If there's meat on the table, she says, who shot it? That's like very rewarding.
Wow.
For my husband and I.
That's kind of cool.
Because,
right.
Yeah, we primarily just eat wild game as much as we can. And so every now and then some pork will show up and we have to try to navigate a butcher. And I don't, it's confusing for her, but we don't know who shot it is the bottom line. okay. On that note, Allie, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation and I definitely learned some things. And I hope that some landowners that you haven't spoken to before reach out to you and take advantage of your expertise. Britta, I don't know if you have any closing thoughts. Otherwise, I'll end it for us here.
No, other than as a thank you to Allie for all her knowledge to share. And if you're in Iowa, give her a call.
Thanks, ladies.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening. Join us next month for another conversation with the women of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever.